Hi, this is Brian Lehrer. You're listening to WNYC On Demand, podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads, available when you want to listen at WNYC.org and iTunes.
Because of the steps we've taken as individual nations and as an international community, the American people will be safer and the world will be more secure.
President Obama is apparently out to earn his Nobel Peace Prize. He's reducing the U.S. nuclear stockpile, as you've heard over the last week, and he brought more than 40 world leaders together in Washington this week to launch a new global effort to prevent nuclear terrorism. We are delighted right now to be able to talk to two of the world's leading writers about nuclear war. Jonathan Schell, probably best known for his classic book, The Fate of the Earth, from 1982. He teaches a course these days at Yale about the nuclear dilemma. His most recent book is The Seventh Decade, The New Shape of Nuclear Danger, published in 2007, and he is with the Nation Institute. Also, David Hoffman, who was awarded a Pulitzer Prize just this week for his book, The Dead Hand, The Untold Story of the Cold War Arms Race and Its Dangerous Legacy. He is has been a longtime Washington Post reporter. David and Jonathan, so great to have both of you with us. Hello.
My pleasure to be with you.
David, anyone who lived through the Cold War heard so much about the arms race, but probably no longer considers the U.S.-Russia relationship a threat. What's the Cold War legacy, to use the subtitle of your book, as it relates to al-Qaeda?
Well, first of all, the Cold War legacy is that we still have 23,000 nuclear warheads on this planet, 95% of which are held by the United States and Russia. If we're not in a Cold War standoff anymore, we need to think about what to do with a lot of those warheads, which are parked in warehouses, many of which are not verified or covered by treaties. And the relevance to al-Qaeda is we have a window, a chance, to make sure no one else gets a hold of one of these, diverts one, or attempts to do anything with them. And now's the time to take care of that, not after it happens.
Jonathan, I gather you are praising some of the president's efforts, but think he's suffering from a strategic incoherence. Is that the phrase you used?
Yes, it is. And I think David really points to what the heart of it is, and that is that 20 years after the end of the Cold War, the United States and Russia are still holding one another hostage to nuclear destruction. In other words, there's a complete lack of connection between the strategic reality of aiming still, even after the START Treaty, it will be 1,550 nuclear warheads at one another. But that has no political reference point. It's just something that sort of sails on of its own momentum. And so our weaponry and even our nuclear strategy of mutual assured destruction, which survives to this day, is completely out of synchronization with the geopolitical reality. It's a very crazy state of affairs.
And David Hoffman, and I should mention that you are contributing editor for Foreign Policy magazine these days, we worry about Iran and North Korea, but you remind us in a recent piece that today, the U.S. and Russia still possess 95% of the world's nuclear weapons. You were getting at that a minute ago, too. Does that matter to the issue of preventing terrorism more than a few states like Pakistan or North Korea or potentially Iran that might have less security or even relationships with terrorists?
Those two things are not mutually exclusive. They're both important. First of all, the states that are unstable or failing are potentially tempting targets for people that would like to threaten the United States and do evil things. And we should strengthen those states and make sure that the nuclear threats are removed. But at the same time, we have to be good stewards and custodians of the legacy of the Cold War, which is the fact that most of the warheads are in our possession. Finally, as Jonathan was just saying, if you are a terrorist or al-Qaeda hiding in the mountains of the Afghan-Pakistan border, what use are these nuclear missiles as a deterrent? Do we think that al-Qaeda is deterred at all by the deterrence that we assembled for the last war? It's time for us to get real and think about the real dangers we face and not the ones from the last war.
So what do you think about what came out of the conference this week?
I think this was a down payment by the president. I think it was an interesting, good start because there has never been an act of terrorism involving nuclear weapons and nuclear materials. And I think by getting all these countries to come here and at least write down on paper that it's their intent to prevent that from happening, it's a good start. Words count. You know, you remember the Helsinki Final Act was a pretty important moment in the Cold War when people sat in a room and said, here are the standards of human rights. Well, that's sort of what's happened here. They've said, here are the standards of nuclear security, but all these countries will go home and make their own decisions. The leaders will do their own thing with resources and standards. So, frankly, there's a lot to be done when they leave here.
Listeners, we have time for a few phone calls for David Hoffman and Jonathan Schell on the nuclear conference on preventing nuclear terrorism that President Obama convened this week in Washington, or some of the larger underlying questions. 212-433-WNYC is our phone number. 212-433-9692. And Jonathan Schell, there was a four-year goal established at the end of the conference. Do you understand what the goal is actually striving for? What is anybody supposed to do in 4 years, and would that matter?
Yes. The goal is to get control over what are called nuclear weapon materials so that they don't fall into the hands of other proliferators or terrorist groups. And those materials consist of plutonium on the one hand and highly enriched uranium on the other, which are the two things that you most need if you're going to build a nuclear weapon. Going way back to the 1950s, President Eisenhower had a program called Atoms for Peace. And the idea was, and this was enshrined eventually in the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, that if you stayed out of the nuclear weapon business, then you would get assistance from the nuclear power, the nuclear armed countries, with nuclear power and other civilian uses of nuclear technology. And the trouble was that some of that technology used highly enriched uranium or plutonium. And so you especially have a widespread of highly enriched uranium in research reactors around the world, about 130 of them. So the idea is to try to get that material under control, to consolidate it, to pull it back, and to do it in a four-year time frame. It's a good goal.
David, anything to add on the goal?
I don't think they'll make it. I just don't. All these countries have different standards. You know, in one country, you have to have the vault closed and locked, and in another place, it's okay to prop it open to give the guard some fresh air. It's a huge problem. A lot of this highly enriched uranium is in little nooks and crannies, and it's hard to find. And the countries see it as an asset. They use it for scientific research, for radioisotopes and medicine. So there are trade-offs here that some of them may be very reluctant to take.
If the goal is unrealistic, then was it all just talk in D.C. this week?
Look, I think words matter and talk matters. But once they leave here, there'll be another summit in 2 years, and I think the actions are going to be much, much harder than the talk.
Bob in Marine Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Hello. Can the two guests discuss anti-missile defense strategy? You know, the late Lars Erik Nelson in the Daily News used to really explain this very well, that even if two opposing countries have a so-called missile defense, which would mean not only missiles but lasers and based in outer space, each country would have to almost be forced to attack the other, would have to launch a first strike because they would lose their ability to retaliate. You lose the deterrence, and so you could not be able to survive like a second strike, or you would lose your deterrence. I couldn't explain it too well, but could you lay it out?
Jonathan, you want to take a stab at that? And I know you've been critical of the Obama administration for not renouncing any U.S. first strike option.
Yes. Boy, it's going to take both of us to talk about missile defense, because everything that there depends on the context in which missile defense is developed. For instance, if you had that system in Poland and the Czech Republic that they were talking about but have recently withdrawn, that was aimed at Iran against some potential attack that might come down the road from the direction of Iran. But, of course, it upset Russia, because Russia was afraid that by having defenses present, the U.S. would be degrading its retaliatory ability and so on. And so the solution was to move the missile defense to the Mediterranean, where it wouldn't threaten Russia so much and would be more directly aimed at Iran. That's not much of an explanation, but it would probably take about 4 hours to go into it thoroughly.
David, you want to add something?
I'd like to respond to this a little bit in the technology sense. Missile defense involves really hitting a bullet with a bullet. It's an extraordinarily difficult problem of engineering and physics. And I think a lot of times we need to ask ourselves, is it worth the investment? They have made some strides in missile defense, and the United States is actually building a kind of a system. But again, let's look at the technology. What are we defending against? The possibility that North Korea could launch one missile at the United States. We already have a large, robust missile defense program underway. Is it really matching the threat? And what really is the threat here? Do we really feel that Iran would launch a nuclear missile, and what will we do to respond to it? I think at some level, at the one that's being built now that Jonathan mentioned in the Mediterranean, research on it, continuing to watch the missile threat, we need to be realistic about it. On the other hand, the idea of a global shield to make nuclear weapons obsolete, as Ronald Reagan said, is a dream. And it was a dream when he said it in March of 1983, and it's still a dream. And the reason is technology. Any defense can always be overwhelmed by offense, by more missiles, by decoys, by things to fool the missile defense. So hitting a bullet with a bullet's hard enough. Hitting 1,000 bullets with 1,000 bullets is hard, too. And we ought to at least be very pragmatic and skeptical about missile defense.
My guests on WNYC, two of the world's most renowned writers on nuclear war, David Hoffman, who just won a Pulitzer Prize this week for general nonfiction for his book, The Dead Hand, The Untold Story of the Cold War Arms Race and Its Dangerous Legacy. He otherwise writes for Foreign Policy these days. And Jonathan Schell from the Nation Institute. He teaches a course on the nuclear dilemma at Yale, probably best known for his 1982 book, The Fate of the Earth, and more recently, The Seventh Decade, The New Shape of Nuclear Danger. And Alice in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Hello, Alice.
Good morning. I was just wondering about the assumption, at least it seems to me the assumption by everybody, that all terrorists would use a nuclear weapon rather than respond to a deterrent. In other words, that the idea is built into the term terrorist that all of these people would definitely use it rather than just behave as we did during the Cold War.
Yeah, it's a great question. Jonathan Schell, what do you think about, I mean, the assumption at the conference this week was that there is no deterring a group like Al-Qaeda.
Well, I think the question is a very interesting one, because I think we should remain open to the possibility that that there could be a group that would acquire a nuclear weapon and not actually use it. Rather, they might brandish it. There conceivably could be some negotiation, and I don't think that those ideas should be foreclosed. On the other hand, if we speak about deterrence per se, I think it's the standard view is the correct one, that you can't deter a terrorist in the sense that you can't prevent them from doing what they otherwise would do by threatening them with a nuclear explosion on their heads, for the very simple reason that they're prepared to lose their lives. And especially you see that with the suicide bomber. It's a little hard to deter somebody if they're already dead.
David, as you tell the Cold War history in your Pulitzer Prize-winning book, do you refer to Jonathan Schell and the impact of his book, Fate of the Earth, in 1982?
You know, Jonathan Schell's book hit the world like a thunderclap. It had a huge impact in that period because there was a very, very large movement at the time protesting the escalating nuclear arms race, especially in Europe. The Soviets had put missiles on the western part of the Soviet Union, and NATO was preparing to station very fast-flying missiles called Pershing 2s. And that book and the protests at the time played a big role in what eventually happened. And it's really interesting because now we can read President Reagan's personal diaries, which he wrote at the time. And one of the amazing things we find as we look sort of into Reagan's mind, at the time, of course, we thought he was escalating the arms race, and in many ways he was. But he also had kind of a hidden ambition to get rid of nuclear weapons, and he shared many of the thoughts of people who were reading Jonathan's book and marching in the streets.
And Jonathan, in The Nation this month, you wrote about the movement, old and new, the traditional anti-nuclear movement groups led by Peace Action and the American Friends Service Committee and people like that are marshaling support for a nuclear weapons convention. And at the same time, there are new groups like Global Zero. Has the movement transformed fundamentally from 1982, or has it just faded away? There certainly hasn't been anything like a no nukes march in a very long time.
Yes, well, it did fade away, but I think there are signs that it is coming back. One rather surprising development is that a whole array of former officials, including officials of the Reagan administration, have stepped forward to champion a goal that they really previously mocked as naive and absurd, and that is what David mentions, the dream of a world without nuclear weapons. It's a dream, by the way, and I would hope it will become a reality that is shared, of course, by our current president. And I actually think that we have an opportunity now to move toward that goal that is probably brighter than it has been since 1945. And we see a certain awakening also among the traditional peace movement. There actually will be a demonstration coming up just before the at the UN, just before the opening of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty Review Conference. So there's some signs of life in that quarter as well.
Abdullah in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Abdullah.
Oh, yes, hi, sir. How are you doing today?
Good. Thank you for your call.
Okay, so my question is, like, I'm a Pakistani-American citizen, and my question is, like, you know, like, every time, like, you, like, I'm on the media, like, I'm facing the news or like that, I mean, so there's a current concern or pinpointing of Pakistan being held for, like if there is a stolen atomic bomb or kind of like that. So my question is, like, why is there so much concern regarding this country? Like, I'm going to say, because if you think so, or if anybody could think, like, nuclear bomb is not kind of a candy which can just be taken off or just like that. Pakistan has a professional army. It's a country with a major big army, as you know that. So why is it so big threat, and why is Pakistan being pinpointed, even though, like, Pakistan is United States' biggest ally and is the biggest friend? So yeah. I would say it's really ununderstandable, because as being a Pakistani, when I listen on the radio or watch on the TV, mm-hmm. like, you know, like, I feel bad, like, you know, as being a Pakistani who is...
You really feel like your country of origin is being unfairly singled out.
Yes, that's the thing.
So let me get a response. David, how much does the AQ Khan scandal teach us in this respect?
Well, I think the caller has a good point that we should deal with facts. But the facts are that of all the countries that have nuclear weapons and have declared them, Pakistan has a lot of instability and a history of some proliferation problems. AQ Khan was a metallurgist, a specialist in highly enriched uranium, who helped spread some of this technology outside of his country. Furthermore, Pakistan and India still remain in a very tense situation. Sometimes they have war games on their borders, and they certainly are serious rivals in South Asia. Furthermore, Pakistan continues to expand its nuclear program with reactors that will be generating plutonium for weapons. And lastly, Pakistan is the scene of a lot of instability. There is a war in Afghanistan. We have seen a lot of this violence and instability. One hopes, of course, that all the nuclear weapons are secure. But I think if you just look at the facts and read a recent report that came out this week from Harvard University's Belfer Center, it points out that this instability in Pakistan is something that we all need to worry about, including the Pakistanis. So I would just suggest to the caller not to close his eyes, but to open them and look at the real facts, and that's the best approach.
The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, Jonathan, recently made it her priority, or did make it her priority at the summit, to talk about dirty bombs and wanted to shift the focus from regular nuclear threats. Is there enough of a shift in focus, in your opinion, and is this a meaningful distinction between dirty bombs and so-called regular nuclear threats? Jonathan?
Distinction between the two. A dirty bomb is really not a nuclear explosion per se. That is, there's no fissioning that goes on. Rather, what it is a bunch of radioactive materials surrounded by or intermixed with conventional explosives, which really become the dispersal device for the radioactivity. So it's really a contamination bomb. And actually, the number of casualties that would result are rather low. They might be in the dozens. There might be more from the conventional explosion than from the radiation. What it does do, however, which is awful, is to contaminate conceivably, depending on wind conditions and so on, a very large neighborhood. So you might get, 50 or 100 square blocks that were contaminated with radiation, and people wouldn't want to live there because they might get cancer. So that's the problem with a dirty bomb. But it's really, in my opinion, whatever Angela Merkel says, it's not on the order of danger of an actual nuclear weapon with fission going on inside it.
I would just like to disagree with Jonathan, because I think he's overlooking the fact that creating a nuclear explosion would be an extraordinarily difficult feat of engineering and physics and chemistry. But if someone could steal fissile material and put it into a truck bomb, the learning curve here is much lower. And the amount of disruption that could occur, economic disruption, panic, would be sizable. I think it is a threat.
So did the conference deal with it sufficiently, in your opinion, David?
I think the conference was about words. Now we have to see with deeds before we can give them any grades.
David Hoffman, his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Dead Hand, The Untold Story of the Cold War Arms Race and Its Dangerous Legacy, just won the Pulitzer this week. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
And Jonathan Schell from, adding his congratulations too, from Foreign Policy Magazine and The Nation Institute, author of books including The Fate of the Earth. Thank you both very, very much for an important conversation.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up in a minute. The war of words, not to mention the actual policy dispute between the New Jersey Teachers Union and Governor Christie. We'll talk to the head of the union. Thanks for listening to WNYC On Demand. Please check out our other programs at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This free service is made possible by our listeners. Become a member of WNYC today.